You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
On the strength of just one novel, Invisible Man, and a series of essays in cultural criticism, Ralph Waldo Ellison stands as one of the major literary figures of the last century. Invisible Man, which was about black identity in mid-20th century America, won a National Book Award in 1953 and a permanent spot on high school and college reading lists. But despite writing more than 2,000 pages of manuscript over the course of the next 40 years, Ellison never completed a second novel. Now, two Ellison scholars have organized those pages into a huge volume called 3 Days Before the Shooting. John Callahan is Morgan S. Odell Professor of Humanities at Lewis and Clark College in Portland, Oregon. He's the literary executive of Ralph Ellison's estate. Adam Bradley is an associate professor of English at the University of Colorado at Boulder. The book is published by Random House, and I'm very pleased to welcome them to our show. John, welcome back, in fact. Did Ralph Ellison work on one specific project all those 40 years?
No. It was his main project, the second novel, but he would interrupt that to do essays. But it was on his mind and his chief project for 40 years.
But how much did it change? I know Invisible Man began as a novel based on his military experience, and then he changed it completely. Were there similar rethinkings in the process of working on this book?
Actually, that's a myth that should be debunked, that he was really... If you look at the archives, there are only a few pages written on the military novel. It was a little bit in his head, and he went to Invisible Man. This thing underwent, the second novel underwent a good deal of change. It's also maybe even more remarkable how much it stayed the same. There are a number of episodes, but the fundamental plot is Bliss and Hickman, the little boy, indeterminate race, and the jazz man turned preacher, and the little boy coming to adolescence and running away from the black folks who raised him. That's the heart of it still.
That's to some degree autobiographical, isn't it?
How so?
Well, first of all, he was a jazz musician. He grew up in Oklahoma. Some of that takes place in Oklahoma.
I mean, there are certain elements, I think, of resonance. I mean, in any author's writing, you see it. The thing that strikes me, though, is the way that we have this conservation of detail across the years. This is a novel, after all, that began, Ellison began it soon after Invisible Man, or even around the time of Invisible Man's publication. And he started writing it in a small composition book, then moved to a typewriter, an electric typewriter, and finally to a laptop computer. I mean, this kind of trajectory of composition, you know, through all of these means of making words, but yet always coming back to the same characters and themes.
And the question that people ask again and again is, why can't he complete this? Arnold Rampersad, who wrote a biography of Ellison, says that winning the National Book Award in 1953 and beating out Hemingway for the prize, plus all the honors, responsibilities, and financial rewards, combined with Ellison's perfectionism, made it increasingly hard for him to produce anything less than a work conceived and executed on a scale that reached grand, perhaps impossibly grand, heights of excellence. You agree?
No. It's too categorical, too simple, too reductionist. I don't think we'll ever know the whys and wherefores of Ellison working on and off for 40 years and not bringing the novel to completion are many. And it's the relationship among these that I think is most interesting. Invisible Man wasn't always a helpful, very ambitious, isn't it?
Yeah. There's the improvisational aspect. He was a jazz musician, a good trumpet player, who believed in improvisation as a writer. And sometimes it's hard to mix all of those things, the myth and the Faulknerian prose and
Joycean prose
and improvisation and everything, and make it into some kind of organized whole.
I mean, the way I look at 3 days, it's almost like unlocking the complete Columbia recordings of Miles Davis or something, where you have multiple iterations of a same song. It's not as if we get bored of hearing Miles play Seven Steps to Heaven just because he does it in a different context, in a different key, in a different, you know, kind of pace to it. And that's what we see with Ellison working through the changes of these different drafts over the years.
And one of the things that I think this book will do, it really will bring the reader into the sausage factory. I mean, sausage standing for the words and the passages, because Ellison was working with similar episodes, themes, sentences even, as Adam suggested, and he reworks them. He, for example, the opening sentence of 3 days before the shooting, he rewrites that in 1991 on the computer. So the reader's going to make a call about whether these are equally good, whether one is better. What happened to Ellis and the Craftsman, the novelist?
Well, he seems to have felt that as he was working on it, he should incorporate what was going on in the country. So that never ends.
No. I mean, he talked about this idea, Leonard, of the aura of summing up. He wanted to sum up America to itself and to the world. And, I mean, this is an audacious claim to make with a work of fiction. And we see him both staying with the putative date of 1955 as the setting for the novel, but then also having it expand to encompass the civil rights movement, the Vietnam War, the women's rights movement, the digital age. Not necessarily,
assassinations.
Yeah, not necessarily explicitly in the themes and the subject matter of the book, but in the way that he approached his original themes.
And there's a fascinating thing about that, Leonard, because I knew Ellison very, very well, and I don't think there was a single time I talked to him by phone or spent time with him in person when he didn't say at some point, "Well, John, it's a crazy country." And I, working through this material, reading the book as we now have it, you know, I don't think there can be an aura of summing up about this country. It's always going to be provisional, and I think that's one of the things that haunted Ralph, trying for that aura of summing up and colliding with the reality that you really can't do it.
Well, you were on the show in 1999 to talk about an earlier version that you put together of the novel, published under the title Juneteenth, which was Ellison's title, wasn't it?
No, it was Ellison's title for one of the key episodes. But he never titled the second novel.
So how is 3 days before the shooting different?
Well, Juneteenth comprises about a fifth to a quarter of the material. It is, I believe, the central narrative. But there are other narratives, and these are other narratives that, as Adam suggested, reveal something about Ellison's thinking, about his craft, about his struggle, perhaps, primarily.
So here you've included everything?
Well, I think it would be...
It's not 2,000 pages.
Impossible. Yeah, I mean, he wrote over 40 years, you know, not writing every day necessarily, but writing consistently and expansively, often, you know, writing as he was his, you know, method was to write episodically. So he would layer episodes on top of one another, not necessarily bringing the transitions together. Transitions always bedeviled him, but he would do those. So we didn't include all of the multiple drafts, but we did include a sampling of drafts at the end to give people a sense of how he would just meticulously work his language.
Well, transitions seem to me to have been one of the problems with Invisible Man. He would say, he would have his character go off to give a speech, and then we'd never hear the speech. We'd always hear what happened afterward.
That's a very shrewd comment. And I would add, Leonard, he got away with it, and I think he got away with it because it was a picaresque novel, because he could hang everything upon the tree of that narrator's voice. And this novel, however, required more from the transition.
Because it's so much more ambitious.
Yeah, and it's not the same. There isn't the same hook, the same first-person narrator, the voice that brings everything
together.
I am an
invisible man.
That's right. He's playing with multiple voices. And yet there are signs. I think the relationship between book one ends, and book one is rougher and less polished in the last version we have than book two, for example. But it is more coherent as a narrative.
Well, he did publish eight separate excerpts from this. Were they polished?
Yes.
Yeah, some
except
were quite
for
polished.
One, perhaps.
Yeah. The last.
The last one he published, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
In fact, it's very interesting. It's called backwhacking, and it's you go, as Adam has done and I've done, you look at the drafts in the Library of Congress, and it's pretty rough there, almost an afterthought. He never really incorporated it, and then when some people asked him for an excerpt, that's what he gave them. So I'm not sure it wasn't a backhanded decision on his part. I wish he'd offered something else, actually.
Yeah. My guests are John F. Callahan and Adam Bradley, who are the editors of Ralph Ellison's 3 Days Before the Shooting, published by Modern Library, which is a division of Random House. Gives us, I guess, the most complete sense of what Ralph Ellison was trying to do. When you spoke to him, John, I'm sure you must have asked him, so how's the book coming along? Are we going to see it completed at some point?
No, I really didn't. It wasn't that
way.
Was
that a touchy point? Was that something you might avoid?
Well, it was a private point with Ralph. He would bring it up. He would bring up the novel, but it was private for him, we had a very close relationship, which was not that of a literary scholar come to collect some crumbs from the master, but really a more filial and paternal relationship. And we would each be done with our work when we get together. So he would talk about it, and I would occasionally simply ask a bit of a question, and sometimes he would answer and sometimes he didn't.
Well, many people have questioned the excuse he gave that there was this fire in 1967 that destroyed his country home in Massachusetts and set him back.
I think that's we can answer that, I think. He wrote letters within 10 days, 2 weeks of the fire, where he is extremely explicit about what the fire destroyed. Quote, a summer's worth of revisions. Later on, as I think inability to finish the novel got more and more excruciating and painful for him, as I think it did, I think he somewhat exaggerated the toll of the fire. The fire probably took more of a toll on his mind. But he still, the next thing he published was something that really any sharp-eyed reader indicated that he was again progressing on the book in 69.
I mean, he had this phrase, you know, that same pleasure, that same pain to talk about writing. And I think we see the pain in something like the fire and in the psychic toll it took on him. But we also see the pleasure he took in his own words of reading them, of hearing the voices that he was crafting. Those exist together in a kind of tragicomic relationship.
So when we read this book, are we reading it like we would read a conventional novel?
No.
Or are we reading it like people who want to understand the process of trying to write a great novel?
I think the latter, Leonard. I mean, and I think it's a book that readers are going to dip into and out of, and we're going to read it as, again, to riff off of what Adam just said, we're going to realize that this is incomplete, it's unfinished. We're going to have a sense, I believe, of the struggles involved, but also the pleasure of when he hits it, when he hits a beautiful sentence or paragraph.
And he was capable of writing many beautiful sentences.
That's right.
Well, you mentioned earlier, Adam, that the fragments were left behind in scrap paper all the way to computer files. So did you have to look at all of those different things in putting this thing together?
You know, we probably looked at most all of them. I know John and I combined have had our eyes and our hands on everything. And, you know, you go to the Library of Congress where Ellison's papers are housed, and you see just a treasure trove of material. I mean, you see notes that he wrote in the 1950s. You see undated notes. Many of them are undated, where you can only look to see, you know, if he's written on the back of a envelope with a postmark, and you know, pick up some of the paper and you can still smell the cigar smoke and the fibers. I mean, this is the kind of richness of the archive as a physical entity as well.
And in terms of what you were just asking about, Leonard, where he hits it, where he doesn't, Ellison, one of his stepfathers taught him to hunt, and he was incredibly...
He grew up in Oklahoma.
Yeah, in Oklahoma. And he used to hunt out there in the weeds, the woods beyond Oklahoma City. And he was incredibly fond, even in his 81st year, of talking about what one of these old guys, these hunters, had told him. Well, son, a hit is history. A miss is mystery. I think that's what we got with this book.
Well, since we've established that he was an episodic writer, that's what he's often described as, Invisible Man doesn't follow a clearly plotted line so much as is a series of dramatic events. Why couldn't he have just done that here and left it at that? There are any number of people who write novels that really are a kind of a string of short stories.
Well, and
we make the connections chapter to chapter
right.
by ourselves.
I think he couldn't. There are three kind of central things he had going. Bliss and Hickman, the little boy and the preacher, the boy growing up to be a senator. McIntyre, the white reporter, well-born McIntyre, who tells the story and brings another perspective to it, and the Oklahoma stuff. And I don't think that Ralph ever figured out whether or how to integrate those into a single book rather than doing, say, two.
So if he'd lived another 5 years, do you think it still would have been incomplete?
I think it probably would have.
Yes.
Ellison was a musician before he was a writer, and he was not just a jazz musician, but also a classical musician. He had the aspiration of becoming a classical composer by the age of 23. And what we see in this novel and in its incompletion are both the riffs of a jazz man, but also the aspirations and grand design of a classical composer.
Before we go, do you have any favorite sentences or paragraphs?
Yeah, I'll give you one.
Okay.
I like the now opening. You know, 3 days before the shooting, a plane load of Southern Negroes landed in Washington's National Airport. And he runs through all sorts of modulations, from 3 days to 2 days, from American Negroes to Afro-Americans to Afro-Americans, you know, all reflecting, Leonard, you know, the passage of time, the passage of identity formation among Black Americans. This evidence is there in the sentences themselves.
Well, to some degree, Invisible Man marks a certain moment in race relations in this country, and mm-hmm. he becomes the first African-American to win the National Book
That's
Award,
right.
becomes a major bestseller and mm-hmm. and an important
right.
voice in the Black community.
And I think
and then from then on, he's watching a lot of changes
that
occur after that.
And here's the cusp of it. Here's the cusp of this novel, this particular sentence. Senator is hallucinating, and he's hallucinating about 1954 and thereafter. Nine owls have squawked out the rules, and the hawks will talk. So soon they'll come marching out of the woodpile and the woodwork, sore head, sore foot, right up close, one butt shuffling into history, but demanding praise and kind treatment for deeds undone, for lessons unlearned, but studying war once more. 60s, Black Power, the whole militant business right there.
My great thanks to the both of you for being with us today. John Callahan is Morgan S. O'Dell, Professor of Humanities at Lewis and Clark College in Portland, Oregon, also the literary executor of Ralph Ellison's estate. Adam Bradley is an Associate Professor of English at the University of Colorado at Boulder. And together they have edited the 2,000 pages left in all sorts of different forms by Ralph Ellison when he died, into a book called 3 Days Before the Shooting. It is published by Modern Library, a division of Random House. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're
welcome. Thank you, Lennon. Appreciate it.